This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association, caring for those who care for you. For more information, check out nhhca.org. And thanks so much to New Hampshire Healthcare Association for continuing to sponsor this First the Nation presidential primary show, as we welcome in Paul Steinhauser just off the plane from Iowa for tonight's edition of the program. Going to be a great show. We have talked to Elizabeth Warren over the last week. Those two conversations. Also, we both talked to Tom Steyer, Paul at the debate, and also he sat down with myself here in New Hampshire. And Joe Walsh did Pints and Politics, one of Donald Trump's primary opponents, talks impeachment and more coming up in the last segment of the program. But first, Paul, you're at the debate, and I'm interested in your takeaways. And really, the biggest moment of the debate occurred after the debate with Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. And as is the case, if there's mics around, you know there's probably some audio of two individuals talking on stage. And in fact, some audio was found.
It took CNN, though, 24 hours from the end of the debate until they... I don't know why it took them so long. It was their debate. It was their microphones. But now we know what was said, of course, and Warren was pissed. And that was apparent from the video, right? She refused to shake Sanders' hand. Now we know that, of course, she accused him of calling her a liar. And he said, in my Bernie accent, let's deal with this another time. Yeah. And she said, hey, I'm ready whenever. So the ill will that we've been talking about.
And Bernie said you called me a liar, too.
Yeah, right, he did. Yeah. He threw it back at her. Yeah. You know, the peace treaty between the two is over, that non-aggression pact. It's obvious that there's a whole new dynamic here between these two candidates, and it's not a pleasant one. They disagreed on some issues at the debate, but now it's getting personal between these two. And obviously it comes at a time when Bernie Sanders has been rising in the polls, brought in a heck of a lot of money the last 3 months. So Warren's had seen a little slippage, both in her fundraising and in her polling numbers. But both of them, Chris, both of them, it seems, made out well financially out of this debate. Bernie Sanders raised a whopping $4 million the past couple of days before, during, and after the debate. Warren hasn't given a similar number, but she said that the first hour of the debate, which is when this showdown happened, was the best hour of fundraising she's had in her year as a candidate.
Yeah, I thought they both came across actually well in this particular instance. I thought that Warren perhaps, won the exchange if you're looking for, which person is more likely to be telling the truth. I mean, it seemed like Warren was more forcing the issue and the point. I think that there's probably a truth somewhere in between about what actually took place during this meeting. I don't think that Bernie outright said that a woman couldn't win, but he perhaps may have said it would be more difficult, or he thought that because Trump was in the things that he said he was and sexist and so forth, it'd be more difficult. Which, Bernie denies saying exactly what Elizabeth Warren says he said. So there may have been some nuance to that. In terms of the overall debate and whether this helps or hurts Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, I feel that, Bernie Sanders, one of the biggest attributes that he has is his authenticity. And you think that Bernie Sanders is legit. He's honest. He has integrity. He's telling the truth when he speaks. So if Warren is going to make a big deal out of that and continue this on, that is, a potential downfall for Bernie. But I don't think it's going to really resonate.
Are most voters paying attention to this? No. But I agree with what you just said, and here's another problem for Bernie. This brings back memories of 2016. And that is not good for Bernie Sanders. We all remember the Bernie bros and their misogynistic attitudes towards women and some of the attacks on Clinton supporters in 2016. This brings back memories of that. This also brings back memories of the beginning of this campaign cycle when Sanders had to survive a controversy that his male staffers 4 years ago were sexually harassing female staffers. So none of this is good for Sanders because, let's be honest, majority of voters in the Iowa who are going to take part in the Iowa Democratic caucuses are women, and women are probably a majority here in New Hampshire of the Democratic primary electorate. That is a problem for Bernie Sanders going forward, especially if Elizabeth Warren continues to beat this drum.
So overall, I think that Bernie Sanders was rising before this, and I feel like there was nobody that really won the night in regards to the debate. And Bernie, though, it seemed, had the night focusing on him. He was at the center of the stage, just like Biden. But in this particular performance, it was him commanding the evening. It was him, bringing the conversation back to things that he wanted to talk about, making key points, interjecting humor. So I think that Bernie's rise continues here coming out of the debate. Let's kind of set the scene for all four of the big four candidates. We'll put Klobuchar in there as well, coming out of that last debate prior to the caucus. We can talk about how impeachment's going to play here, too, because it is going to play significantly. I think that Biden didn't really do anything to change the trajectory of how individuals feel about him.
He did no harm. Stays
the same, did no harm. Buttigieg, I thought the same thing, but Buttigieg kind of needed a little bit more, I thought, to continue his trajectory, because he has been sliding a little bit. Warren, I thought, needed a little bit. She had a very good night, but I thought she needed a little bit of a better night. Klobuchar, I thought, needed a home run. I thought that she needed to make the whole debate about her, because she needs to win Iowa if she's going to win the nomination, in my view. So I didn't see that happening for her. So the trajectory doesn't really change. Bernie continues to ascend. Biden's in good position. Buttigieg is in good position, but could have been in better position. And Warren not just has this dynamic of being a little bit behind everybody, she's also going to be off the campaign trail. And she's not in a bad spot polling-wise because she's a little bit behind, but has room to obviously grow and move up and was within shouting distance. But not being able to be one-on-one with voters and holding events in Iowa and New Hampshire, that's really, really going to hurt her, because I think she does really well in those settings. And as she meets voters, she wins over voters.
Yep. No, agreed. You know, Bernie's going to have the same issue, right? He's going to be off the campaign trail, as is Klobuchar, and even Senator Michael Bennet of Colorado, who's a very long shot for the nomination. But it's different. I think Bernie supporters are going to be with Bernie if he's there or not. The Bernie bros love Bernie. It's one of the reasons he raised that $4 million right away. But that doesn't expand his base. That keeps his base where it is, which is a good place. Whereas Warren does have to play a little bit of catch-up ball, so maybe it does impact her a little bit more. As for Biden and Buttigieg, they're both doing bus tours in Iowa. They're each making stops back here in New Hampshire in the coming week or two. So they've got that flexibility that the senators don't have, because they're not going to be under lock and key in Washington, D.C. Bernie's going to be right back here in New Hampshire this weekend, and Buttigieg is coming as well on Friday. We tape this, obviously, on a Thursday, so we'll have those interviews with Buttigieg next week.
That is Paul Steinhauser. I'm Chris Ryan. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Final thing here in this segment before we get to our conversations with Elizabeth Warren, and that is the endorsement of Annie Custer of Pete Buttigieg here in the Granite State, which I think is very, very significant. I am not a huge fan of endorsements. This one I am a big fan of, and here's why. She may be the only member of our four individuals in the congressional delegation who actually endorse. Hassan has told me that she is still deciding whether she is going to endorse. Jean Shaheen has told me she is not endorsing, and Chris Pappas is in the same boat as Hassan, not making a determination as to whether he's going to endorse. To me, Custer could have gone in one of two directions here. She could have endorsed Joe Biden and given him, a stamp of approval, or you go out on a limb a little bit and you endorse Pete Buttigieg. And to me, I think that Custer endorsing Buttigieg is not going to make any one individual say, oh, now I'm voting for Pete Buttigieg. But what it does is there are a lot of people who are in the same boat as her that are just independents and moderate Democrats who are deciding between Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg. And to have an individual like Annie Custer, who has really been engaged in this process and has gotten to know all the candidates, she's done events with all of them, to say Pete Buttigieg is the person that I feel is best to be president instead of Biden, I think that resonates a little bit with voters. Now, is it going to change their minds? Probably not, but it is going to stick with them, and I think that that's significant.
Here's another thing about Custer. I think I'm talking with her later today, ahead of the Buttigieg event tomorrow on Friday. I think she liked Cory Booker a lot. I saw her a number of times with Booker, and I think there was a lot of good connections there. Booker just dropped out of the race, and she had I may be wrong, but maybe she, quietly he was her first choice. He's gone now. I agree with you, though. This one will make a little bit of a difference. Endorsements normally don't matter at all. This one will. We have a very small delegation here, all Democrats. We know Shaheen will not be endorsing because she's running for re-election. So this one is influential, and it helps in parts of the state that maybe will get Buttigieg a little bit of maybe Warren supporters and maybe even a few Bernie bros, though I highly doubt that. But remember, Custer's part of the state there, you know, you got some big Democratic centers like Concord, like Keene, and like the Upper Valley. These are meccas of liberalism, having that kind of endorsement is only going to help Pete Buttigieg, especially as he battles the two progressive standard bearers of Warren and Sanders. And it also may turn some heads, as you mentioned, as well, with people who are thinking about Biden.
That is Paul Steinhauser. I am Chris Ryan. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. We return. We both talked with Elizabeth Warren, first Paul's conversation and then mine when we return. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan, along with Paul Steinhauser. Both of us sat down with Elizabeth Warren over the last week, and Paul sat down with her in Dover. I did in Milford, and here is Paul to intro his conversation with Senator Warren.
Yeah, when I spoke with her, it was as the crisis with Iran, the crisis with Iran was really the hot story. And that's how we began. We talked about the U.S. military airstrike that took out the Iranian military leader Soleimani.
It's funny how this cycle moves, isn't it? I mean,
so incredibly
fast. We were on the brink of war with Iran a week ago.
And now it's ancient history.
And now it's like, oh, everything's cool. We don't have to worry about that anymore. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, and she also made a little bit of news when it comes to her pledge, which she's repeatedly said that she, if she's elected, she will not allow big bucks donors to become ambassadors. But I asked her about Gordon Sondland and whether she opposed him. Of course, he was the ambassador to the Ukraine we all know about now, actually to the European Union, that made a lot of news in the impeachment inquiry in the House. And that became a big story. But as you said, Chris, it was eclipsed like 5 seconds later by the sexism controversy. But take a listen. Here's our interview from about a week ago.
Sure. This morning, the Wall Street Journal had some reporting that seemed to vindicate what you and others were saying when it comes to the president, whether this was politically motivated.
Yes.
I'd like to get your reaction.
You know, when President Trump first announced that he had had Soleimani killed, I thought, why now? We've known about Soleimani for years. What's the reason it's not last month? What's the reason it's not next month? And does this have to do with the fact that we're right here on the eve of impeachment? Is he looking for some kind of a, you know, get us talking about something else? Turns out it was more direct than that. He, according to news reports, told his associates that he was under pressure to take out Soleimani. And these were important senators who are going to be important to him during an impeachment process. You know, once again, this is Donald Trump using his power as president in order not to advance the interests of the United States, but instead to advance his own political interests. And this is like what he did in Ukraine, for which he's being impeached. Only this one takes us right to the edge of war. And that means the threat level is magnified many times over. This man is a danger to the United States and to the world, and we need to get him out of the White House.
You brought up Ukraine and the impeachment process. Mm-hmm. One of the key witnesses was Gordon Sondland. Mm-hmm. You've said a number of times on the campaign trail that if you're elected to the White House, you won't name unqualified big donors.
Yep.
You've got a new ad out, I think, this morning on that with sound from Gordon Sondland. Uh-huh. When his nomination was up in the Senate, did you raise any objections at the time?
You know, when he came through, I think most of these guys came through on consent. I objected to mm-hmm. all of them. And I do object to all of them because Donald Trump has made it clear that he has taken a process that has been far too cozy in Washington for far too long. And that is just sell the ambassadorships one after another after another. And that's why I have called on my fellow Democrats in this primary to say no, no more of this. We are not going to appoint big donors to be ambassadors. We're going to appoint people who are actually qualified to be ambassadors, who have some history, who have some experience in this, that is in the interest of the United States, and it avoids this whole notion of trading quid pro quo.
When his nomination was up and some of the others, did you vote no or not in favor?
You know, I would have to go back and look at the individual ones. Okay. There have been a lot of ambassadors that have come through. But we have a problem overall with the ambassadorships. And the problem is, for far too many, it's make a donation, get an ambassadorship. That's something, obviously, that's not available to middle-class families, and it's not something that is advancing the interests of the United States, and it needs to stop.
I was with you last week when you were in Concord.
Uh-huh.
I heard something a little different, and Politico picked up on it as well. I think they wrote about it yesterday. You've seemed to be making more of the electability argument lately, that you are the one who can unite the party, the progressives, the moderates. Julian Castro just this week down in New York with you at that huge event in Brooklyn saying the
that
same
was
thing.
Fun.
It looked like a lot of fun.
Uh-huh.
Saying the same thing, that you're the one who can do this. Are you concerned that two of your main rivals, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, if they're the nominee, will not be able to unite the party?
Look, I think uniting the party is terrifically important, and that's something I can do. I can do it because I've got a clear focus on what we need to get done in this country, what's broken, and how to fix it. And also because I want to work with all the Democrats. I want to work with all the Democrats and the independents and the Republicans to get the things done that we agree on. I want to build on our successes. You know, one of the principal things I've talked about since the first day I showed up here in New Hampshire is corruption. Talked about how Washington works great for those with money, not working for much of anyone else. I have had out, since before I ran for office, the biggest anti-corruption plan since Watergate. And here's the thing, that corruption issue, boy, it resonates all across the Democratic Party and catches independents and Republicans. They understand they're getting cheated. When I talk about the importance of the 2-cent wealth tax, it's something that works for Democrats, for independents, and for Republicans. When I talk about expanding Social Security payments by $200 a month and disability payments by $200 a month, that's something that works all across the spectrum for Democrats, for independents, and Republicans. I think for our party and for our nation, this is a moment we need to focus on the things we really want to do together. Because if we can knock back the influence of money on Washington, we've got a chance to make this government work, not just for those at the top, make it work for everyone else. And that means improve our public schools. It means have the money to fight back on opioid abuse. It means have more money to put into housing so we increase the amount of housing stock. Do the things that touch people in their lives.
To put it bluntly, though, with your good friend Bernie Sanders,
uh-huh.
Do you think he's perceived as too far to the left to do what you think you can do, which is bring both sides of this party together?
Look, you need a political pundit to talk about who's perceived as what. All I can do is tell you the things I've been fighting for, mm-hmm. and that I've tried really hard not to pick a bunch of fights with my fellow Democrats. I've tried really hard to talk about the things that unite us as Democrats and unite us as Americans. Things that are important. Things that are real change, things that could be transformational. Universal child care will transform the lives not only of those babies, but of their mamas and of their child care workers and of local communities that will have an infusion of money and young families can live there. Do things that are important, but things we can agree on as a party and as a nation.
You're going to be at the debate next week.
Uh-huh.
Tom Steyer just qualified, but
yeah,
it looks like Andrew Yang won't be making it. It looks like this will be an entirely white debate. Does that trouble you, and why are the minority candidates not resonating in the polls?
I agree that this is a problem. We started out with such an importantly diverse field, a field that had lots of different voices, lots of different perspectives. For me, the hard day, the particularly hard day, was the day that Kamala Harris announced that she was dropping out of the race because of money And on that same day, a billionaire bought his way onto the debate stage. You know, that's just not right. That is not how our democracy should work, and it is certainly not how our primary should work. I hope Andrew makes it. I guess we've got until the end of the day, and there are more polls coming out, so I don't know where that stands with Andrew. But part of the strength of the Democratic Party is that we hear from lots of people, lots of different perspectives, and that's how we build a strong party going forward.
You were with William Castro. He's endorsed you. Is he somebody you would consider as a running mate? And are there other names you could talk about?
It would be presumptuous to talk about running
Everybody
mates
says that,
this time. But they say it because it's true. It would be presumptuous. Oh. I've known Julian for years. We worked together on housing issues a long, long time ago. And I've worked with him on issues for the disability community, how to promote real equality. Worked with him on the importance of universal child care. Julian is a good man. He truly is. And for him, public service is about how much good you can do. And he's all in on that. And instead of taking the position once he decided he couldn't go forward in the race, you know, he could have just backed up and kind of kept his cards close to his chest and hoped someone else would look at him, lots of people would look at him, whoever our nominee ends up. He said he wanted to stay in this fight, and he wanted to stay in this fight with me because we're fighting the same issues in the same way. And I'm so deeply honored to have Julian in this fight with me. He's a great partner.
Last question, then. Let's have some fun. You always talk about the selfies.
Yes.
You talk about it every time.
Mm-hmm.
Technically, they're not selfies. You're not taking, or the person you're with is not taking the picture. And I'm wondering, has anybody ever asked you? They're more, you know, they're not technically selfies.
Hey, look, people get a picture on their own phone the way they want to devise it with the group they want to have. I think it goes within the big definition. And everybody has fun. And that's what it's all about.
And are you worried if you're stuck in D.C. with this trial? You've got a great approach, you know, great rapport with your voters. Are you concerned about being there and not here on the campaign trail?
I'm concerned about democracy. The real advantage to being able to have a primary here in New Hampshire is to be able to talk to people. You know, when I get out here today, I'll say a little bit at the top about what's going on, a little bit about why I'm in this race. But I'm going to open up to whatever questions people want to ask. These aren't pre-filtered. I get to hear from people. And then in that selfie line, I get to hear the little individual piece. And sometimes it's a specific thing. Please be careful about expanding disability payments. We're really getting hurt on this part and this part. Very, very helpful. Sometimes it's just, you give me hope. You talk about what's broken, and you talk about how to fix it, and you persuade me we can do that. Do it together. That's what democracy should be about, having that back and forth, that give and take. And I want to be able to do that in person because that's truly the heart of it. Our democracy works great right now for rich people who run a bunch of TV ads. But if that's what it's going to take, if you've got to be a billionaire or suck up to the billionaires, then we're in real trouble as a country, because it just means our country will work better and better for billionaires and worse for everyone else. I'm in this race because I want our country to work for everyone, and that starts with a democracy that works for everyone, and that starts in town halls just like the one right here in Dover.
Senator, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Appreciate the time.
So good to see you.
Short time later, Senator Warren joined myself along with Todd Fahey in Milford for our focus on issues affecting the middle class, brought to you by AARP New Hampshire. So, start with a process question, though, and you know, how you feel you have to do here in New Hampshire. Your campaign started off strong here and continues to be one of the leading candidates here in New Hampshire. Given your proximity to the state and given the effort and focus you had, do you feel that you have to win New Hampshire or get very close to that in order to have a shot at the nomination?
You know, I just don't think of it along those lines. What I think of it as, I have a chance to get out right here close to home and talk to people in a real face-to-face, you know, just a close way, up close and personal way,
about what's really gone wrong in our country. How we have a government down in Washington that's working great for rich people, working great if you can hire an army of lobbyists and lawyers, just not working for much of anyone else. And boy, you know, folks in New Hampshire really seem to get that. And that's true whether they're Democrats, Independents, or Republicans. And that's what I like about New Hampshire. Boy, they're ready to talk about the issues, and they'll talk about them when they come to town halls, but also in cafes and on the sidewalk. Mm-hmm. Because people realize 2020, this is a big election coming up. It's not the next 4 years or the next 8 years. It's the direction our country takes for generations. And for me, the central part of this is really a who government works for. Those at the top or for everyone else?
The middle class has, as you've highlighted a lot during the course of this campaign, has been under severe financial distress for a long period of time. And many middle-class independents voted for Barack Obama and Donald Trump with the hope that someone would change the trajectory that they were facing. And your campaign is focused on that. What I'm curious about is, why would you be different? And why would you be able to change the trajectory when others have not been able to do so in the past? What specifically about your skill set would allow for that change?
So let me start with, this is my life's work. I didn't start out, you know, at 26 saying, oh, I'm going to be a politician, and then I'm going to run for this office, and then I'm going to run for that. Nope. I'm somebody who grew up in a family hanging on by our fingernails to the ragged edge of the middle class, desperately wanted to be a teacher. That was completely out of range for my family, couldn't send me to college. I got married young, dropped out of school. My big chance was a commuter college that cost $50 a semester. And for a price I could pay for on a part-time waitressing job, I became a special education teacher. And one door opened another. I ended up in law school, ended up teaching, but then spent my whole life in working on one question. What's happening to working families in this country? Why is America's middle class being hollowed out? And as I saw it unfold year by year, the things just got tougher and tougher for middle-class families. Our country got richer, but the family just kind of in the middle sort of had about the same wages, but the cost of housing and health care, child care, sending a kid to college just shot through the roof, and families got squeezed harder and harder. They quit saving. They went into debt, and of course, the financial crash of 2008 was about millions of people that just got wiped out. I began to understand the real problem is corruption. It's about a government that works well for those with money. It's about trickle-down economics that started in the 80s that said, in effect, help the rich and powerful get richer and more powerful, meaning cut their taxes, that's how they get richer, and cut the regulations that control some of these businesses, and that's how they get more powerful. And if the rich and powerful get more powerful, somehow it's going to help you. Trickle-down economics has been a monumental failure for America's middle class, for America's working families, for America's poor. It's been a monumental failure for everybody except those at the top. So I start this with an attack on the influence of money in Washington. I have the biggest anti-corruption bill since Watergate. And that's something that's popular not just with Democrats, but with independents and Republicans. If we start out by knocking back the influence of money, just disrupting it, just at least making the effort. Don't just give in to it. Let's put these guys who take the money on their back foot. Now we got a chance to make some real changes. A 2-cent wealth tax, and then we can cancel student loan debt for 43 million Americans. We can invest in housing and bring down the cost of housing for millions of people. Let seniors age in place and people with disabilities have access to housing. There's so much more we can do if we have a government that works for America's working families.
We're going to get to Todd and a lot of the important issues to AARP here in a second, including prescription drug costs and aging in place, as you referenced. But a lot of the things that you mentioned that are popular with Republicans and independents poll well with them. But if it came down to a President Elizabeth Warren saying that this is what you need to do, there would liable to be a lot of no's and opposition that you face. And you're
Why?
because that's the way that Washington works. That, remember, obviously, Mitch McConnell
said
that he wanted...
Oh, you mean the guys in Washington. Yeah. I thought you meant the guys who elect.
No.
What
the,
you're really saying is democracy doesn't work.
Right. And so how are you going to make your democracy work in this instant when it has not worked for many, many years? And Mitch McConnell said his goal was to make Barack Obama one-term president when Obamacare was being debated. So why would it be different? And how do you make Washington work in all these different institutions that you see as being corrupt, a democracy that is broken? What dynamic do you bring that would make it work?
The inside-outside game. You've got to do both at the same time. So let me do a very short, I'll try to tell the story in a short way. And that is the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. You remember this down in New York, early part of the 1900s. More than 165, mostly immigrant women, were caught in this fire. They jumped to their deaths or burned in the building. And here's the thing. People have been protesting for years out in the streets. There have been big rallies. But the factory owners were making a bunch of money from not having any safety standards, from keeping the doors locked. And they just go, back then it was Albany instead of Washington, but they go to Albany, to the state capitol, grease a lot of palms, give a lot of campaign contributions, and nobody changed the rules. So a young woman named Frances Perkins just happened to be visiting in New York, saw the fire, and said, wait a minute, we could make change. She worked with the folks who were organizing, mostly unions, but not all. And she went to Albany and got herself appointed the head of a new commission on fire safety. Now, keep in mind, this is before women even had the vote. So she heads up this commission. She gets a bunch of rules changed on fire, and then she goes after labor rules. Well, one thing and another. Franklin Roosevelt gets elected governor. Then he gets elected president of the United States. He brings Frances Perkins with him. She becomes the first woman in the U.S. cabinet. She's Secretary of Labor. And basically, here's what she does. She says to working people, keep pushing from the outside. Push, push, push. Because that's how we'll hold Congress accountable, so long as I'm pushing from the inside. You push from the outside, I'll push from the inside. We'll focus on one issue at a time, and we'll get this done. And what did she get done? In just a short period of time in the 1930s? Well, a minimum wage, Social Security, the right to join a union, the end of child labor, and my own personal favorite, the weekend. All of that happened from inside outside. Inside can't do it by itself, especially now, but outside can't do it by itself either. So I think of it this way. I've spent this year campaigning and building a grassroots movement. We're now at about 2.5 million contributions to my campaign. In. People are in. They pitch in $5. They pitch in $10. They volunteer an hour. That's the heart of the grassroots movement. And we continue to build that. That helps me win in the primary. It helps Democrats up and down the ticket win in the general election. But here's the key part. I say to everyone, you can celebrate for 24 hours, but then it's back to work. Nobody gets to go home. You got to keep pushing to hold our Congress accountable. Then job number one, when I'm elected, is to go after them on the anti-corruption, disrupt the influence of money. Once we do that, and that's popular, we're going to hold everybody accountable on that. Once we do that, now we go to the next one, the 2-cent wealth tax, also very popular. Start with the things that are popular. Start with the things so that young people can say, wait, you just cancel my student loan debt? And that's going to happen for Democrats and Republicans. Wow, this is the first time the government has been on my side instead of government as debt collector. That's how we build it and start to change. And I got to tell you, increasing Social Security payments is another one of those. Popular across both sides, let's start by building on those.
That is Elizabeth Warren. This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association.
This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan with Paul Steinhauser as we inch closer to the First Nation presidential primary. I'm not sure inch is the right word, perhaps sprint closer to the First Nation presidential primary. Both Paul and I talked with Tom Steyer. And of course, Steyer was a key figure in the debate in Iowa on Tuesday, but not really because of anything that happened on the stage, which is unfortunate. I thought there was a tremendous opportunity for Steyer where he wasn't really able to make a compelling argument to voters. But instead, it was afterwards where Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders were confronting one another, it appeared, and Tom Steyer was right there and is right in the middle of it. And afterwards, he wouldn't tell anybody if he had heard anything, and he said he didn't. And you talked with him in the spin room in Iowa as well.
Yeah, I did. And when I was – he first did a live interview on Fox with Peter Ducey, and I was with him. And in all the live interviews he did, he kept saying the same thing, which nobody believed, that he didn't hear a word of what they were saying. Tom was just trying to – Steyer was just trying to stay away from that one.
Right.
He heard it. He just didn't want to repeat it. But then I asked him about foreign policy. Why? Because out
you
of
You could tell from the look on his face that he heard something.
Oh, yeah. You know he did.
Yeah.
But he was playing dumb in all the media interviews he did.
Right.
But foreign policy was the first issue – in the debate. It was the first time foreign policy was clearly front and center in any of these Democratic presidential debates. It made sense because it was coming out of the crisis with Iran. And I asked Steyer about, whether he had the chops to really handle foreign policy. And he took an indirect shot at the former Vice President Joe Biden. Take a listen.
When it came to foreign policy, which was a big part of this debate, do you feel you were able to hold your own?
There's no question about it. Look, I've traveled around this world working for three decades. I've dealt with people all over this world. If you want to know someone who actually understands how America engages internationally, actually, I'm that person. So we tend to want to look at foreign policy as this question about America being the policeman of the world, and it's all about military policy. But if you actually look about what America has to do in terms of coordinating with our traditional allies, being value-driven, and understanding what goes on in the real world in a different way of thinking about it. Yes. I'm the person who has that experience. And Paul, what I said on the stage was this. This is about judgment. The two people who I think have had the best judgment were a state senator from Illinois with no experience who went against the Washington establishment in the Iraq War, Barack Obama, and was right. And an African-American congresswoman from Oakland, California, Barbara Lee, who went against the Washington establishment when every single other person voted and she was right. So when you say to me, we really need to go back to the experience that Washington has brought us, I would say, actually, I think we need something new here, Paul.
I talked to Steyer last time he was here in New Hampshire in Laconia.
Fine, as I was thinking about this on the drive up, where we're having really warm temperatures this weekend here in New Hampshire, and it's so much so that we may not see any snow on the ground, which is unheard of. And I was talking with a friend about, you know, the way that we used to see all the time the lakes and ponds freeze over and there'd be ice skating and things of that nature. Do you feel that the physical evidence that we're seeing, although anecdotal, is contributing to interest in the climate and individuals making the appropriate steps to do something about this? Or are you feeling that there still has to be a greater push and understanding for there to be real action on the climate?
Well, I think everybody, I think the overwhelming bulk of Americans knows this is happening. I think the overwhelming bulk of Americans know it's happening because of human activity, and the overwhelming bulk of Americans are for clean energy. I don't think that's really up in the air. I think the question in America is not what do we think or what do we want to do. It's how hard do we care, how much do we care about it.
Right.
I've said it's my number one priority. And my opinion is where you prioritize this isn't directly related to your age, but it's correlated with age. Young people, this is their number one priority because they're looking at a future that could be dominated by this if we don't do the right thing. And so, you know, to me the question here is, there are two time schedules going on here, Chris. There's a time schedule that Mother Nature is dictating, and there's a time schedule that American politics is dictating. And at the moment, they're not lining up together. And can I tell you, as I like to say, Mother Nature is not giving you an extension on your paper.
Right.
Physics is physics. It's going to happen. You can talk till you're blue in the face. Mother Nature doesn't care. And so we have to do the right thing. And if you're going to be a leader, then you have to tell the truth and do the right thing to protect the health and safety of every American. And by the way, we can do it in a way that cleans up the air and water, provides millions of good paying jobs, has cheaper energy, and makes us grow faster. Yeah. So this is not like I'm saying eat your gruel. I'm saying this is a chance to rebuild America in a really positive way and lead the world in the biggest challenge we've ever had, which is a great thing for America. So actually, I view this as, yeah, it's a huge challenge and we have to deal with it. We also can deal with it, and we can deal with it in a completely positive win-win-win way.
I want to ask you about Iran, both from a strategical foreign policy perspective, but also from a political perspective. And when you look at the situation as it has evolved with Iran, what do you see if you were president of the United States being the things that you would do in order to de-escalate this even further and to create an environment where there is not a concern, or perhaps, you know, you would agree that there should be a military solution here?
Well, Chris, let's start with the idea that President Obama was doing a pretty good job in Iran. You know, he was working with our allies in coalition to do it, to get a treaty with Iran where they gave up their nuclear ambitions. And that was increased, in my mind, the safety of Americans around the world and stability in the region. What President Trump did was withdraw from that treaty and begin to escalate both in terms of language and violence. And that's continued till today. So when you say, what is the right thing to do now? You know, I used to say to my kids, here's the rule. Don't call me up at 3 a.m. and tell me you got drunk and got in an accident. There's no good answer. Don't drink and drive, period, the end. That's an absolute rule. And that's what I'd say here. Look, obviously, once you're in a mess of your own creation, that you've got to figure out how to de-escalate it. Okay, that's a fair question. But the real question is, don't get in a mess. Have a strategy. Work with your partners. Have true values and goals that you're open about and consistent in. We're doing none of those things. Have a process so that you can make sure that decisions are well considered and work towards a greater strategy and take everything into account. None of those things is true. Mm-hmm. This is not rocket science. Look, we have 20 years, in my mind, of failed military activity in the Middle East. Just look back and see. But the longest running war in American history, a war we got into on false premises, and now we're talking about another situation that is being escalated without a strategic goal, as far as I can tell, without any kind of process or, you know, sense of where we're going, and where we are absolutely isolated in the world community. There is no one agreeing with us in what we're doing.
And the president made very clear that he was for a more isolation-based America-first foreign policy, but it seems that there's these various aspects of military or diplomatic adventurism that he engaged in, whether it's with North Korea or whether it's in the situation with Iran. I would say even, you know, dating back prior to 2003, I mean, there's been a lot of circumstances in which the United States has become engaged in a diplomatic process in other nations, whether it's with Gaddafi in Libya or even going back to the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. So what would, in your view, a succinct foreign policy under your administration look like, and what would you want to see in this realm?
I mean, across the board?
Yeah.
Look, I believe in a value-driven American foreign policy that puts the safety and welfare of Americans first, but that we work in alliance and coalition with the other freedom and democracy-loving countries around the world who are our traditional allies to create an environment where Americans are safe and can prosper and where the world as a whole moves forward towards democracy, freedom, and prosperity. Simple. Now, then you have to make a ton of tactical decisions mm-hmm. to make that happen. And as the world actually comes together, as it is in fact doing, you're going to have complicated relationships with countries. You're going to have trade relations. You're going to have defense relations. You're going to have democracy relations. You're also going to have the need to come together as a globe to combat climate change. So in all of those things, yeah, actually living up to that to that goal is complicated. But actually, you need to have that goal, and then you need to be evaluating every decision on a tactical basis in the context of where you're trying to get to and how it takes you there, knowing that there'll be trade-offs. You know what that's called? Organization, culture, strategy. That's how you run everything. It's just here the stakes are very high, so you have to actually be good about it. We have not seen that happen in American foreign policy, certainly from this president, but I would argue know, we really haven't had success in the Middle East, at least strategic purposes, in decades.
Final thing, I want to ask you about... This is On Background, presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan. Appreciate you joining us for the show. Joe Walsh, former congressman from Illinois, joined us for Pints and Politics at the Barley House. He is one of two individuals primary challenging Donald Trump, the other former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld. That primary is not really being discussed at all. This says primaries, GOP primaries, are being canceled across the country and being done so there's not any competition for Donald Trump. Here is Walsh at Pints and Politics.
So, in terms of the apparatus and the difficulty, as you were referencing when you walked in, Wisconsin canceled there.
I'm pissed off.
Yeah,
I don't mean to interrupt. No,
that's fine. That seemed like it was a starter right there of a greater expansion into your mind.
I wanted to come in to Pints and Politics in a jovial Irish kind of a mood, but I'm pissed.
Our drinks haven't arrived.
No, we don't actually have pints. You reminded me when you
Where's that alcohol?
Yes, you reminded me when you said that. We have no pints yet.
We have no pints. I'm drinking a cappuccino. We got to change that.
Yeah, will.
We found out about 30 minutes ago that Wisconsin became, by my count, the 10th state in this country to say no primary. No primary challenge to Donald Trump. This isn't Russia or China. This shouldn't happen in America, and it's never happened before like this. I mean, never. So clearly the Republican Party's trying to protect him, but as you say, it makes it difficult.
You mentioned you're upset about the process. We'll get to Dean here in a second. Mm-hmm. But are you frustrated with individuals from within your party?
Amen.
The Mitt Romneys, the John Kasichs, for not stepping up and planting their flag and saying this is not appropriate?
Absolutely. Because, look, I'm out there every day screaming that Donald Trump is a pathological liar. He can't tell the truth. He puts his own interest ahead of the country's interest. He's a narcissist. He's cruel. Everything I say publicly about Trump, out there every day, Romney, Kasich, most of my former colleagues in the House and Senate agree with me privately. They believe the same thing about Trump that I say publicly, but they don't have the courage to say it publicly. That really, really disappoints me. And again, as I said, maybe there's a better candidate than Joe Walsh to take Trump on. But the better candidate hasn't had the courage to take him on.
Dean?
Congressman, talk your belief that President Trump isn't fit for office is well known. You spent some time in Congress. My recollection is you came in 2010 as part of the Tea Party Rebellion, big moment for Republicans. Let me ask you a little bit about your sense of the appropriate role for Congress, particularly on the current situation with Soleimani in Iraq. The Democrats in the House are now moving a war powers style resolution.
Good.
We know that Congress has been trying for most of the past 50 years to take back some of the executive power. Talk a little bit about your sense of what you think the appropriate role for Congress should be in this.
To declare war, to do what the Constitution says they have the authority to do. Now, I don't want to declare war, but again, as you rightly say, for 50 to 60 years, Congress has abdicated, not just in this area, but in a whole host of areas, their constitutional responsibility. And so in a way, in a weird way, it's not a surprise that we've got a guy like Donald Trump who believes he's above the law, who believes he's a dictator and a king, and who believes he can basically ignore a branch of government. It disappoints me because I thought a lot of my fellow Republicans believed as I do. But right now they're bowing at the altar of Donald Trump. If I were in Congress right now, I'd be right there with Nancy Pelosi to grab some of this constitutional power back.
So, given the current situation, do you think did Trump have a responsibility to consult Congress in advance, or did he actually need some sort of resolution and support? How far should he have gone?
So it's my belief that he should have consulted with Congress. prior to the strike.
But not necessarily asked for approval.
It's my opinion that he probably should have asked for approval.
Okay.
Because it seems pretty clear to me that if they had evidence that there was an imminent threat, which is maybe the threshold that we could give a president right now. We haven't seen that evidence.
Right. So I'm not sure that we will.
And I'm not sure that we will, because I'm not sure that it exists. Because like in everything else, Trump lies about everything. But so I would have preferred congressional approval, certainly congressional consultation.
Okay.
And anything moving forward, any step moving forward, has got to be approved by Congress.
Do you think that this is taking place as a result of the politics of the situation? Do you think that Donald Trump is concerned with his own political future more than the country's future?
Okay, so I'll say it. Yeah. I mean, what do we know? What is the one certain thing we know about Donald Trump? All he cares about is Donald Trump.
Right.
When you look at every single action he's taking since he got sworn in, it's all about to advance the interests of Donald Trump. It's why he made that perfect phone call with the president of Ukraine 3 or 4 months ago. He didn't give a damn about the country. He wanted to help himself get reelected. So, to answer your question, I find it absolutely plausible, if not believable, that he acted to take the heat off of and the attention off of impeachment. And I believe in Donald Trump's sick mind, he believes that if he's sort of seen of as a wartime president, or there's something going on in the Middle East, then maybe we should postpone impeachment. Some of his sycophants have even said that.
Do you think that, why do you think that Republicans and individuals that you've respected in Congress have fallen into this role of sycophants?
Because they're scared to death of his voters. They're not scared of Trump. They're scared of his voters. They don't like Trump. They don't respect Trump. They think, like I do, that he's a moron. A lot of them, actually, the Republicans, they want him to lose this November because they want him just to go away. They're afraid of his voters. They want to get reelected. I know Jim Jordan well. Jim Jordan and I are friends. I don't recognize him now. Because if I were still in Congress, I'd probably be the only Republican voting to impeach. And they know what Trump did is wrong. Again, I don't think they're afraid of Trump. They're afraid of his voters.
Do you think that what he did is impeachable and he should be removed by the Senate?
And I'm not being a smartass, but I'll answer it like this. If you use the powers of your office to force a foreign government to help you cheat in an upcoming election, if that's not impeachable, I don't know what is.
And you think that's been proven?
Oh, I think that's been proven. Bring on the trial and bring on Bolton, bring on Pompeo and my former colleague Mulvaney, because you know that they will only bolster this case and then remove him from office. But bring on a fair trial.
What do you think about what Biden has done in regards to this? Where, in my view, if I were Biden, I would say very clearly that, yes, I will testify, but I want to see Mulvaney, I want to see Bolton, I want to see Pompeo, I want to see Barr, and that's what I want to do in exchange for my testimony. Do you think Biden has handled this well?
I do. I wish he'd be more forthright in and say it just like you said it. I mean, what Biden did and what Hunter Biden did has nothing to do, nothing with what the president did, but Joe Biden should stand right here in Concord. He should have a couple weeks ago and said, okay, I'll testify. Man, if they want me to testify, I'll testify. Donald Trump, how about you testify? You don't have the balls to testify. How about you make Pompeo, Mulvaney, and Bolton testify? Absolutely. Biden should have been a hell of a lot stronger.
This is On Background, and it's presented by the New Hampshire Healthcare Association. I am Chris Ryan for Paul Steinhauser. Have a great rest of the day, everybody.